Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings, welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking about advertising, its role in our society, how it got that way, and how Americans responded to advertising when it became such a dominant institution in the first part of the 20th century. Our guest will be the author of a brand new book, Advertising on Trial. So join us today for Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The United States is not the only country suffering from media consolidation and an over-reliance on profit-driven sources of news. Des Friedman with Goldsmiths College at the University of London says things are much the same in the UK, even with the existence of the BBC.
One company, you may be not surprised to find out that it's Rupert Murdoch's company, controls one-third of daily circulation of the press in Britain. Five groups control something around 85% of newspaper circulation. We have one company that basically controls the major commercial terrestrial television channel. We have one company that overwhelmingly dominates pay television.
In Brazil, according to Graciela Seliman with the Information Network for the Third Sector, the problem is even worse with intimate connections between media and the political establishment.
In Brazil, 30% of the senators have some kind of relation with TV channels or radio channels, and 130 congressmen are proprietaries of media.
And then there are the countries where media remains marginalized by a lack of reliable infrastructure. Emmanuel Ijenga Jaguna, who works with the South Africa-based Association for Progressive Communications, says the digital revolution is a long way away in Africa.
Radio is still the widest accessible means of communication. At least 70-80% of households have radio. Then just everything then starts to diminish. They are on, like, the internet, then you only have about 2%.
Given the similarities and differences in the media environment around the world, how can activists for media reform globalize their efforts? Mai Young-jun Kim with Media Act in South Korea thinks the key is to work on multiple fronts, one of which involves creating alternative, independent media.
We should have some strategy to intervene and to create the political tensions inside the mainstream media, but at the same time, the basic activism should come from the independent and alternative media activism.
In South Korea, independent media makers have the advantage of government subsidy. 24-hour public access cable and satellite TV channels exist, and the government gives a generous allowance to citizen producers. Graciela Siliman thinks it's good that media reformers around the world are linking up, but she says change can't take place unless the fight goes on locally.
Globalizing media reform or communication rights should mean finding ways of putting in a global perspective or local experience and needs, while at the same time understanding in what way the global debates make sense for local community and how to put the concepts we believe in and fight for into practice.
The next global convergence of media reformers will take place in Memphis, Tennessee, between January 12th and 14th for the third National Conference for Media Reform. To learn more and pre-register, visit www.freepress.net/conference. Kenneth Tomlinson, the disgraced former chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, is back in the news facing new allegations of abuse of power. Although he was ousted from the CPB for attempting to impose an ideologically conservative bias on public radio and TV programming, Tomlinson still chairs the U.S. Broadcasting Board of Governors, which oversees the Voice of America and other government-run media made for international consumption. But a new report from the State Department's Inspector General says Tomlinson's abuse abused his authority there as well. How? Well, he put at least one friend on the government payroll, overbilled the government for his own time, and used BBG staff and resources for personal purposes. These include the management of care for some thoroughbred racehorses that Tomlinson owns and breeds. Not much is known about them, but they most certainly are not part of the government's international media outreach. For his part, Tomlinson calls the results of the year-long investigation just another partisan smear attempt. Tomlinson's already been renominated to his post, although these latest revelations may put that in jeopardy. The Senate committee, which needs to reconfirm his tenure, has announced it won't do it before the end of the year when Tomlinson's term is set to expire. Unfortunately, both the state and justice departments have declined to open a criminal investigation into the Tomlinson affair, although he still may face a civil suit in hopes of reclaiming some of that misspent money, which amounts to at least $250,000. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois on this lovely September Sunday, 2006. Today we're going to be talking about a theme that we often return to on Media Matters, which is advertising, the role it plays in our media system, the role it plays in our culture and society. And we're fortunate to have today in our studios as our guest the author of a brand new book, Advertising on Trial, Consumer Activism and Corporate Public Relations in the 1930s. The author of this book is Inger L. Stoll, an associate professor in the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. The book has just been published by University of Illinois Press to considerable acclaim. Inger Stoll, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you.
The book, Advertising on Trial, Consumer Activism and Corporate Public Relations in the 1930s. In a nutshell, what's the book about?
Well, the book deals with the first organized sort of consumer revolt against advertising, which took place in the 1930s. And basically how corporate interests, who did not like that consumers disliked advertising, devised a series of public relations attempts to beat back any kind of meaningful resistance to advertising, efforts to regulate advertising.
Well, don't keep us in suspense. What happened?
Well, you probably guessed that one.
Yeah, I think our listeners probably had that.
Exactly. Well, of course, consumers lost, and that's probably why we are where we are today.
You know, a lot of people, and my students and I teach in the same unit you teach in, assume advertising is this natural phenomenon, mm-hmm. that it was something that is built into the American DNA genetic code, or that it's in the Constitution, but it's just as American as apple pie. Is that what your research has shown?
No, it isn't. But what you're saying is absolutely true. People tend to have that opinion. And it's not really very surprising, because advertisers have been very successful in impressing upon people that advertising really is an all-American apple pie institution, or however you want to put it. But really, advertising is a fairly recent phenomena. Basically grew out, advertising as we know it today, sort of grew out of big corporate formations after the Civil War. And that's when we see product advertisement the way, we see it today. Of course, it was different then, but the sort of the basic structure was established after the Civil War.
So if you were reading a newspaper in 1830 in Jacksonian America or 1792, you wouldn't have been flooded with the sort of advertising we take for granted today.
No, and because before the Civil War, most advertising, nearly, I would say, 99% of all advertising was regional. It was not national. It was after the Civil War that corporations were seeking a national market. And there were that sort of drive was linked very closely to a development in other parts of, media, for example, national magazines, national newspapers, and so on and so forth. So there was a corporate need for these things to happen, and it happened to be, a media that could sort of deliver.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Inger Stoll, author of the brand new and provocative new book, Advertising on Trial, Consumer Activism and Corporate Public Relations in the 1930s. Inger Stoll is an associate professor in the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She had this book published by University of Illinois Press. It just came out this summer. I mean, it's just when is the release date?
I think it was early June.
Early June was the release date. It's out in paper. It's been very well received so far. This show has been pre-recorded by a few days, so please don't call in today. Sit back, relax. Let us do the yakking today and enjoy the weather and enjoy the show. Now, how did most American – let me preface this question by saying this. When I was a kid in the early 1960s, I remember the day someone told me that commercials and television weren't part of the natural television of experience, but the companies actually had to pay to put them there. I was shocked. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe that they'd pay. I thought they were just part of TV. They were part of the experience you had in our media system. And it seemed natural to me mm-hmm. that advertising would be there and that advertising was just part of the American environment. How did Americans respond to advertising? When it was new, when it was the first time this sort of happened, when you had this sort of immersion in advertising commercialism in the first part of the 20th century?
Well, in the very early years of advertising, I think, you know, people didn't have – I know I'm talking now about the turn of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. Actually, people did not, you know, object too much. There were too many other things going on. And, in fact, in the very early days, people probably thought advertising was something, you know, nice and colorful. And there were even stories of people sort of collecting ads and putting up in their living rooms and so on and so forth. However, by the end of World War One, in the 1920s, advertising just took off as wildfire. And there were other things that sort of tied into the sort of growing public suspicion, because World War II was also a period when the government had engaged in quite a bit of propaganda.
World War One. Yeah, that's right. World War II also.
Yeah. It keeps on going, doesn't it? World War One. And so in the 20s, there was sort of this kind of, you know, sort of suspicious feeling among people that, you know, we are being, you know, told things that benefits other people, and someone wants us to do things that aren't necessarily beneficial to us. And advertising sort of got, you know, clearly lumped in with other forms of propaganda. And there was another thing also going on, and that was that, you know, up till about the 1920s, a lot of people had lived on farms. They had lived in close proximity to most things that they produced, or if they didn't, they were, you know, pretty, you know, on good terms with the corner grocer or the person who sold them stuff, or they could sort of, you know, go and look at the barrel of grains or cereal or, you know, flour or whatever, and sort of basically
they weren't branded products.
No, they weren't branded products. Sense. Yes, and people really had a, you know, sort of closer proximity to what they were consuming. With advertising, with branded advertising, as this, the more and more products become branded, people were increasingly forced to rely on ad slogans for the things they were buying. And, of course, more people had moved to the cities. It was like, you know, a rush to urban centers at the time. And many people had moved from other parts of the world to America. And there was much more reliance on brand. And clearly, very often the brands did not measure up to what they promised.
And another factor that you write about in the book that I think, you know, it's obvious, it makes perfect sense, but when you read it, but you don't really fully appreciate it otherwise, is that with advertising, I mean, the idea of advertising is for a company to sell its product. Mm-hmm. So, you know, or the business has no incentive necessarily to be telling the most complete story about the product mm-hmm. or necessarily the most honest story. The idea is all's fair in love and war, and this is clearly a business war to sell the product. So in the early 20th century, there was just widespread fraud, bogus ads with extravagant, you know, claims that couldn't be backed up, and almost no government recourse to challenge offensive advertising that's filled with lies.
Yes, that was that was actually an effort, another consumer effort that took place at the turn of the century, mm-hmm. and that is commonly referred to as the first wave of consumer activism in the United States. And really what that movement, you know, concerned itself with was, you know, labor practices and product, you know, fraudulent, you know, products, mm-hmm. you know, rotten meat.
Upton Sinclair.
Exactly.
In the jungle, this is famous progressive era consumer
exactly.
tome, yeah.
But at the same time, you know, advertising had not developed to the point it had by the 1920s. So mm-hmm. advertising was not really on the table or actually didn't enter into the discussion to the same extent as it did, you know, 20, 30 years later.
Well, what could, when there were fraudulent ads in the period before the 20s and 30s, what recourse did consumers have? I mean, what would you do if you, you know, you, an ad said, if you take this, you're going to defeat cancer, or you're going to have become more beautiful, or some lame ad, and then it didn't work?
Well, they couldn't do anything. There were a law that had been passed in 1914 that basically regulated, you know, unfair business practices. So if you had, you know, a company, let's say you had company A and I had company B, and I thought that you were making claims in your ads to sort of hurt me in a business sense, I could go to court and I could, you know, get you punished for what you were doing to me as a, you know, business, right? Mm-hmm. But if you are an individual...
consumer.
Consumer, exactly. You know, feeling that, you know, you had gone out there, you bought a, you know, a product, and then you ate it or, you know, used it whatever way that advertisers, you know, indicated you should, and you were, you know, you were sick or died or whatever, there was nothing really you could do. And there was one famous case back, I think it was in the, sometimes in the 20s, I forget the date, but it was sort of in 20s, 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called the Marmola case. And it was basically a Marmola was sort of advertised as a diet cure. And it was a very effective diet cure because people got very, very skinny, but it contained tissue-burning chemicals. So, in fact, they died.
Yeah, and I guess that would solve your concern about your
exactly,
weight.
Exactly, exactly. And after, you know, I think close to 100 people had died from this. You know, the relatives and so on just tried to just, you know, go to Marmola and say, stop advertising this stuff. This is horrible. And the producer basically said, well, you know, we had the law on our side. Of course, they did that after a while, but they initially claimed that they didn't have any, you know, mm-hmm. any obligation to pull the ad. And they were right, actually.
Well, this really highlighted then the fact that consumers had no power against fraudulent advertising for bogus products.
It did.
That they're really stuck on their own. It's the let the buyer beware. And for a lot of Americans, that apparently wasn't something they were happy with. And I think what your book chronicles, and I've never seen anywhere else, Inger Stoll, is the emergence of this consumer movement that was specifically concerned with strictly regulating advertising and limiting the effects of commercialism in our culture. Talk about the extent of this movement, if you would, in the 20s and early 30s, because I think most Americans today would be astonished to know, you know, how many Americans, the number of whom, really were concerned about advertising.
Mm-hmm. Well, it started in 1927 when a guy named F.J. Schlink, that was actually his name, and another person named Arthur Callett sort of got together, and they were sort of talking about the, you know, advertising and, you know, a lot of issues surrounding advertising. And they sat down and said, well, this is really, you know, we have a problem here. And what Schlink did was to sort of, you know, he had like a little sort of group that sort of grew out of a... I think it was a men's group mm-hmm. in White Plains, and he decided to publish a little flyer where every week or whatever he would publish the results of product testing. He would go in, pretty much what Consumers Union does today, of mm-hmm. course, in much you know wider.
And this is before Consumers
oh,
Union.
Oh yeah,
was
this
formed.
Is like in
we'll
the.
We'll get to that later.
Yeah, that was like in the. In 1927, he started, mm-hmm. and then by 1929, he had really grown into a you know a big you know big ordeal, and so Callett and Schlink decided you know this would really could really take on, and they created a group called Consumers Research,
mm-hmm.
and Consumers Research again did pretty much what Consumers Union does today, took products into laboratories, and I've seen pictures of their labs, and, you know, they were pretty, you know, basic, but tested everything from, like, you know, Ryan stockings to toothbrushes and toilet papers, and, you
know.
They
developed quite a following for this, didn't they?
Exactly. Within 5 years, I think it grew from like 500 members to about 55,000.
Mm-hmm.
So by 1933 or 34, this group was really hopping.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to testing products and, you know, sending these reports out, and actually people had to pay to get the newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to doing this, Schlink and Callett were also very concerned about advertising, clearly, because that was really what they had started, you know, helping people understand what was in this, you know, the testing process in the first place.
The products were one thing and the ads were entirely different.
Exactly.
And misleading. Yeah.
Because what they were arguing was that, you know, if the government went out and bought something, or if a business went out and bought something, they wouldn't just say, well, we're buying steel or, you know, rubber or, you know, grease or whatever, just because there was a, you know, pretty girl, you know, on the box or in the advertisement for the product in a trade magazine. So they wanted specifications. They wanted to know, you know, all this. I don't know much about specifications for steel, but they want to know all these qualities.
They check it out, test it.
Price for the best quality.
Yeah.
And they wanted to empower the consumers to do the same, and that's why they set up this little, you know, testing service with bulletins.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Inger L. Stoll, associate professor in the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Inger L. Stoll is the author of the brand new book, Advertising on Trial, Consumer Activism and Corporate Public Relations in the 1930s, just published by the University of Illinois Press, came out this summer. We are pre-recording the show by a couple of days, so please don't call in if you have any questions. Sit back, relax. Let us do the yakking. We'll be back live with you next week. But today, enjoy the show and enjoy the lovely early September Sunday afternoon. We're talking about the rise of the consumer movement in the United States in the 1920s and 1930s and its organized opposition to advertising, or its call for a very severe form of regulation of advertising such that it would serve the public interest and not the corporate interest. This is what Stoll's book chronicles. Tell us, you've been talking about consumers research, this first group that emerged in the late 1920s to critique advertising, and I guess it emphasized, you said, product testing.
Mm-hmm.
And then where did advertising, how did it start getting involved and interested in the regulation of advertising?
Well, what consumers research did was to sort of, you know, go out and try to pressure advertisers to provide more information in their ads.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say there's a sort of very interesting story that sort of ties into this, and that goes, you know, into the Roosevelt administration, that really, for the first time ever, became interested in consumers as an interest group. I mean, the Roosevelt administration knew, very interestingly enough, that the consumers were an up-and-coming group and they
mm-hmm.
had to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
So consumers research had a lot of support in, you know, in the government.
In the Roosevelt administration.
Exactly. However, how solid that support was is questionable, but at least to advertisers, that was threatening.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, consumers research, which by now had grown into a fairly big organization, that attracted a lot of very influential people. People who are community leaders, very often religious leaders, you know, school teachers, professors, people who reach a lot of people
mm-hmm.
beyond, you
mm-hmm.
know, their daily life.
Mm-hmm.
And so advertisers were worried about this.
Yeah.
But consumers research said, you know, all we really want is you guys to be, you know, accountable. We want you to provide information in your ads.
Information that would help people make right
exactly.
decisions.
Exactly.
You know, tell the truth.
Exactly. And, you know, you should just deal with them as rational people, and you should treat them the way you think you would like to be treated. You know, if someone has to part with 20 cents for a cake of soap, which is a lot of money during the Depression, you know, you should, you know, give them a reason why they should buy the brand name versus the generic kind of maybe sold for 5 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, give them a chance to understand that this is, in fact, a better product. And not just one product that will sort of maybe down the road make them look like a movie star or a sports hero or whatever. So, you know, advertisers were scared, really scared about this.
You know, one of the things that was striking, in addition to consumers, at the same time that consumers' research was emerging and taking on advertising and getting a lot of popular support for this, there was also a lot of just public criticism and humor and critique of advertising. Mm-hmm. It's a subject of tremendous ridicule, sarcasm, and at times of anger by the public at the insulting tone, at the idiotic content, far more than you know, I would have ever imagined until I read your book. Talk mm-hmm. a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, the consumer activists, in addition to running consumers research, they did write a long series of books, basically books that, you know, told people how fraudulent advertising was, and, you know, 100 Million Guinea Pigs was one title.
I think the title says it all.
Yeah. And then one was 40 Million Guinea Pig Children, Your Money's Worth, and so on and so forth. It was actually a big industry of books sort of exposing corporate America and its methods.
And these books sold like wildfire.
They did. Two books, Your Money's Worth and 100 Million Guinea Pigs. And they sort of lumped those two together as a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And sold, I think, 250,000 copies. And if you think about, you know, the population at the time, about 120 million people.
Yeah, 40% of what we are today.
Exactly. And so that would be, you know, same as selling 600,000 copies or 700,000
yeah,
copies.
We're not quite in Stephen King territory, but we're getting close.
But, and there's also, you know, people in those days didn't just, you know, you go out, run out and buy a book.
Yeah, they library use, books usually.
Yeah, and one library in Massachusetts, I think it was, had a 2-year waiting list for one of those books.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, they were very popular. And if you go to any, you know, university stack in America, you'll find rows of these books.
And then there was Ballyhoo Magazine, which is a really yeah. interesting story in your book. Well, tell me about Ballyhoo Magazine.
Well, I don't know too much about Ballyhoo, but all I know is that it was a magazine that sort of lampooned advertisements. And it was published in 1931. It's pretty much like, you know, National Lampoon or, you know, Ballyhoo. No, sorry, Adbusters maybe in its early years.
Mm-hmm. Mad Magazine.
Mad Magazine is what I meant.
Yeah.
I said, yeah. And would do today. And it was caught on as wildfire. It was published for the first time in 1931. And within 5 months, there were, I think, a million copies being sold.
In the very depths of the Great Depression.
Exactly.
Unbelievable.
This is what people want to use their money on.
Yeah, spent critiques and ridiculing advertising.
But it does tell you something that, you know, while those, the popular books might have sort of caught on with some people, there were many more people who could sort of, you know, grab onto the humor because humor has a way of, you know.
It resonated deeply
yes.
in the culture. So we've
Absolutely.
Got consumers research is formed. We've got this lot of people interested in the subject, and we've got a booming advertising industry going into the Great Depression. We have no federal law to regulate advertising. We've got, you've already talked about this scandal with Marmol or whatever the product mm-hmm. was that mm-hmm. Was advertising a diet cure and ended up curing all problems by killing you. What happened? Roosevelt gets elected in 1932. He's a reformed Democrat. This movement's percolating. Then your book goes to Washington, and you talk about what takes place in the 1930s in Washington on Capitol Hill as law after law is proposed and debated to regulate advertising. How, in a nutshell, what sort of goes on there?
Well, advertisers did not want to, you know, adhere to any of consumers' research's claims. In fact, they hoped these people would just go away and hide, and this whole problem would go over. It didn't.
And by advertisers, we should be clear, we're not talking about mom and pop grocery store on the corner that might advertise in the weekly paper. I mean, when you talk about advertisers, we're talking about
national advertisers.
They're the 200 or 300 largest corporations in the country that do most of the advertising.
Maybe even fewer.
Yes. Even then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. So advertisers, didn't, like this at all. So what consumers research did was to draft a bill. And it was called the Tugwell bill. And Rexford Tugwell.
Who was in the Roosevelt administration at that time.
Yes. Yeah. He was
Commerce secretary, wasn't he?
No, he was a secretary, agricultural secretary.
Agriculture, that's right.
And he was assistant agricultural secretary. Sorry about that. In the bill, which is, even people in consumers research knew it was a really, really, draconian bill. Basically, what they wanted was to abolish false and ambiguous advertising.
And false, we all sort of know. Ambiguous is where it gets very interesting. Explain why that is such a controversial and considered draconian measure.
Yes, and you're right with the false, because even many advertisers were actually happy to get rid of some of the false advertising, because there had been a lot of pressure on the industry, and they sort of felt if they had a law sort of, getting rid of false advertising, or at least presuming to get rid of false advertising, they would not have any more pressure. But ambiguous, that meant basically that all product advertising, meaning brand advertising at the time, would have to be more or less abolished or at least reformed. Because what brand advertising does is sort of to infer, certain rewards from the use of a product. You can go to any, ad on TV or in magazines or whatever, and really what they're selling is sort of the experience, the feeling, the sense of belonging, or sort of the hope that, by consuming this product, I will, be a cool person, I will belong, I will have friends, I will be accepted. I mean, really, that is how advertising works. So the ambiguity is really that, you can't really pinpoint anyone down. If I say this is what I get out of an ad, someone else might say, well, you're completely wrong, I didn't get that impression.
Yeah.
And this is where advertisers, were claiming. They were saying that, you can't regulate ambiguity, because mm-hmm. who can regulate opinion?
Yeah, that's right. But the law, had the consumers research had their way, would have said basically, you can't hint at some claim, even if you don't directly say it, but it's clear if you have a pretty girl next to a lawnmower in a bathing suit, you're sort of hinting that there's some sort of sexual payoff with this lawnmower. That's not going to be acceptable. Is that a fair way?
Exactly. And consumers research, or the people behind the Tugwell bill, just wanted advertisers to have the burden of proof. Say, okay, fine, if you claim this is not ambiguous, you back it up. You say, okay, if your intent is to suggest to consumers that by using a product, these great things will happen, okay, that's up to you. But then if someone challenged you, you have to deliver.
In short, they wanted advertising content to be useful to consumers before it was to advertisers.
Exactly, back to sort of reflecting the testing and the effort to regulate and make, advertising or consumer more useful as consumer information.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Inger L. Stoll, author of the brand new book, Advertising on Trial, Consumer Activism and Corporate Public Relations in the 1930s. Inger L. Stoll is an associate professor in the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I am the host, Bob McChesney. Today we're pre-recording the show by a few days before we go on air. So please sit back, relax, listen to this extraordinary story about the fight over advertising in the 1930s and what it means for today. Let us do the talking, and I'll be back on the air with a live program for you 1 week from today. Now, the consumer movement, part of your story, one of the most interesting parts of it is, the Tugwell bill gets introduced, and there's all this sort of Capitol Hill shenanigans going on between the various parties, and the advertising industry is very powerful. At the same time, the consumer movement goes through this enormous fracture and reconstruction itself in the 1930s, and a lot of it had to do with the fact that the number one consumer issue of the 1930s was advertising. So you talk a little bit about what happened in the consumer movement.
Yes. Before I get to that, let me just say that, you know, this whole fight, I mean, when people hear about it, I think that, you know, the people in, you know, in, at Consumers Research and later Consumers Union were these extreme radical, you know, wild people who wanted to get away with capitalism, wanted to completely reform society and just, you know, build it up from scratch and make it into like a socialist, you know, country or something. But that really wasn't so.
Mm-hmm.
The consumer movement's claim basically was that, you know, we have capitalism. Capitalism is here, and we just have to sort of make it accountable.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't. If you read, you know, what advertisers were talking about, then you think that these people were just out to just, you know, get rid of civilization. I don't mean to say that, you know, capitalism is civilization, but I'm sort of paraphrasing them.
Yeah. Well, to them, capitalism was civilization.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was, you know, it was framed that way then, and even now when we look back, it might seem like that because it's hard for us to envision a society where advertising really is, you know, legislated in the interest of all of us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that this is nothing, you know, part of our, like, you know, natural cultural landscape. It's nothing inherently mm-hmm. democratic about it.
Mm-hmm. So the consumer movement in the mid-1930s, Consumers Research is leading the fight to mm-hmm. have strong regulation of advertising. Yet in the mid-1930s, there is this civil war of sorts in the consumer movement and the birth of consumer union. Talk about that, would you please?
Yeah, that is sort of what happens by the mid-1930s. Is that this guy who started Consumers Research, Schlink, mm-hmm. Is getting increasingly weird. He's getting very paranoid. He's getting very controlling. He's, you know, getting very out of line, although he doesn't see that himself. And a lot of people find it very difficult to work with him. And some of the workers decide that, you know, their needs aren't met and they really want to form a union.
Mm-hmm.
And Schlink, you know, hits the roof. And he at that time hired his wife, who had actually come on board as a writer, and then he later married her, and a third person. And the three of them were, you know, sort of represented the old faction. And Arthur Callett, you know, sided with the workers, and most of the workers were really, you know, against Schlink and his anti-union activities, and it was a really terrible fight, and especially in the midst of, you know, of the, you know, the Depression, when all these labor issues are very, very sensitive.
It was the central social issue of the time by far.
Exactly. And
labor.
And where Schlink and, you know, Callett and Consumers Research had in a way been seen as the people who are opposing, you know, capitalism, meaning, you know, these advertisers. So people were completely caught by surprise mm-hmm. when this happened. And I, you know, from the outside, it looked like a really chaotic and confusing move. But in the end, Consumers Union was created.
By the dissident workers.
By the dissident workers and Arthur Callett, who had been in with Schlink from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And from there on, a horrible scenario sort of unfolded where Schlink spent all his time trying to undermine and trip over the people in the Consumers Union, who basically, you know, did something very, very interesting. And the early years of Consumers Union were just absolutely fantastic, in my opinion. For example, they made a very honest effort to try to rate consumer products according to the working conditions under which they were produced. They mm-hmm. also tried to reach out.
So really link up labor issues and consumer issues. So,
exactly. Yeah. And they also tried to reach out to organized groups, including labor. They were not too successful in that. At the same time, they were pushing the fight on Capitol Hill for, you know, this Tugwell bill, which by now had just completely lost steam due to, you know, some really sleazy activities on behalf of advertisers, which I hope we can get back to in a second. But basically, Consumers Union was a, you know, was a very impressive group.
And, you know, one of the things that when I read this book that really struck me, and I think few of our listeners will be have any idea this could take place, they'll be, they'll share my surprise, was that when the House Un-American Activities Committee first convened in the late 1930s, the first group it came after, before labor, before the communists, before the Nazis, which obviously were the number one issue at the time, was the labor, was the consumer movement. It was the consumers' union. I mean, it was. I mean, I guess the way that struck me was, you know, the role consumers played in our society as a social movement was so much larger than we could imagine today, where it seemed really sort of a peripheral movement for the most part.
Yes, and it tells us a little bit about who really were, you know, sort of behind the UAC activities too. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you know, some really powerful, you know, conservative people who happen to own corporations.
Yeah.
And, you know, initially the investigations, you know, at least on the surface, are supposed to sort of weed out fascism and communism in the United States. Of course, everyone knew that, you know, they didn't really care much about fascism. All they were looking for were communists.
Yeah, yeah.
And they weren't very successful in finding communists either. So then they zeroed in on the consumer movement. And this is where sort of this fight between the old consumers research and a new consumers union sort of played into the hands of these UAC people.
Mm-hmm.
Because Schlink, again, really completely, you know, crazed out, had gotten it into his mind that the reason the workers didn't want to stick with him was that they were communists.
Mm-hmm.
And that Callot was a communist, and that everyone who had, you know, any kind of, you know, contact with Consumers Union, which was, of course, everyone in the sort of broader consumer movement that had developed at that time, because it was not only consumers research and consumers union existing. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was a big movement that there were many, many small groups, some national, some local, that sort of teamed up and formed a whole sort of social movement now. So he claimed that everyone concerned with these issues were in fact communists. Now, there might, you know, the reason why this had probably a little bit of attraction was that there might have been people who had, you know, flirted with communist thoughts back in the early 30s when this was clearly something that a lot of people were thinking about. There might be people who gone to meetings, there might have gone, you know, who were, you know, in this movement, but there were no people who were active communists by the end of the 30s.
Now, when Consumers Union joins consumer research and they're leading now the fight against for strict regulation of advertising, it's their number one issue, really, as they get started in the 1930s, mid-1930s. Obviously, the advertising industry, the big corporations, weren't too excited about this. They were on Capitol Hill with their lobbyists. They were doing their work. And one of the really interesting things in your book is, in the subtitle of the book, is Corporate Public Relations of the 1930s, Consumer Activism and Corporate Public Relations, is how this advertising industry uses this new area of public relations to sort of put a fig leaf over its naked self-interest and really sort of sell the institution of advertising to the public and try to undermine the arguments of the consumer movement.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And that is sort of the what the advertising community had going for it was, of course, a lot of money. And, you know, very liberal access to mass media, control over mass media.
Yeah, the media certainly depend on advertising
exactly.
dollars.
Exactly. And with those two tools, they were basically able to sort of, you know, undermine and co-opt and marginalize the consumer movement. And, of course, they had money to pay off politicians up on Capitol Hill too, and they used that option also, not surprisingly. Mm-hmm. And so basically, what happened was it was a big effort, big PR effort, but it was not an orchestrated PR effort. It was not like a central agency saying, "Okay, guys."
Mm-hmm.
We have to beat back the consumer movement and you do this and you do that and so on and so forth. No, it was everyone was sort of, you know, there were lots of small sort of institutes, the major advertising interest organizations had their programs, publishers, you know, conservative groups. There were a lot of sort of loosely, you know, connected groups that sort of fighting the consumer movement. But what they did so well was that, you know, they created this kind of pseudo consumer groups.
But today we would call it AstroTurf groups.
I mean, that's fake, a very good
fake
term.
Grassroots.
Exactly. Yeah. Sort of third party groups that were sort of created to sound as if they were, you know, acting in the consumer's interest. For example, the Consumers Advisory Council, you know, there's a long
list. Your book
list.
Is filled with these
exactly.
bogus groups that are created by the industry.
Yes.
But they're ostensibly independent consumer groups.
Yes. And very often they sort of advocate some kind of like, you know, conservative middle ground, like, you know, advertising has given us all these fantastic things, you know, and so why would we want to regulate it? You know, maybe there's some, you know, bad apples in a wonderful barrel of bright apples, but, you know, we can't just throw the baby out with the bathwater. So we shouldn't regulate. And people were confused. And this is where mass media sort of plays a role, because these groups are very successful in getting their stories planted. And no one would explain to the people who are reading this stuff that, you know, hey, this is actually a story that's been planted here by, you know, this or that, you know, association, this or that corporation or whatever. And at times, advertisers would pressure media owners and say, you know, if this Tugwell bill that's out there to basically prevent us from advertising the way we have always done it, if that goes through, you can kiss some of your advertising money goodbye.
Yeah.
A lot of it.
And so, got their attention.
Exactly. So if you are smart, you know, they didn't even have to pressure them. They could just sort of, and I have come across correspondence where advertisers or sort of conservative interest groups are sort of basically sending these memos to editors and publishers. And, you know, the implication was that, you know, to the extent that the Tugwell bill or any, you know, other sort of discussion of efforts to regulate advertising what had to be, you know, discussed, it should be very brief and not really contextualized. Not
One of the things that was striking in your book was just looking at the way with the national radio networks like NBC, blatantly broadcast pro-advertising industry stuff without giving the other side any airtime whatsoever. If you listen to national radio, you would have had on one side of the story, it would have been like being in the Soviet Union and expecting to hear a debate on Stalin's performance in 1938.
Yeah, and it's especially astonishing considering that at that time, the networks really had an obligation. You
legally,
know that better than
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
To provide both sides of the story.
But I guess the first obligation was their bank account in that period.
Yes.
Well, you know, the one thing that also, and there's so much in this book I want to talk about, but before we close up on the legislative fight. What I think it was a long discussion in your book was that the one area that the consumer movement did have sort of some strong footing in and could compete was in schools, since so many school teachers and educators were concerned about advertising. And they did their best to raise the issue of advertising and its role in our society in the nation's classrooms. And that became a major battleground for this fight, as you document in the book. Talk a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, as I mentioned earlier, because, you know, school teachers were basically one of the first groups to sort of catch on to the consumer movement's, you know, issues. And it was this kind of sort of growing understanding that, you know, we are living in a consumer society. This is like in the 20s and 30s. And, you know, we educate kids to become citizens and, you know, people who are going to function in society. So why not educate them on consumer issues? That makes a lot of sense,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, educators would you know, talk about these, you know, these publications that the consumer movement sent out. They would have bulletins that they would sort of discuss in the classrooms. And advertisers were getting really nervous because kids come home from school and say, you know, ads, you know, aren't all they're cracked up to be and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And this is where advertisers make their big move, because although there had been advertising in schools back in the 1920s, but it was very, very little. And by the mid-30s, advertisers just, you know, pulled out, you know, everything they had.
All the stops.
All the stops, exactly.
It's truly incredible. So I reread this just the other day. It's amazing what they did.
And they sort of basically flooded schools with all kind of advertising products. There were charts and booklets, films, there were radio shows. There was one outfit called the Homemakers Educational Service, which worked as a clearinghouse. And the only role that clearinghouse had was to was to deliver sort of information between schools who could use promotional material and advertisers who wanted that material placed in schools. And they were super busy. And again, you know, all kind of charts and booklets and so on and so forth. And I've seen some of these, and it's in the instruction, you might, you know, say, okay, well, you know, this class lesson is about, you know, telling the kids about, you know, the use of a special, you know, face wash, and they would talk about it, you know, how do, you know, pimples occur, how do people have, you know, greasy skin or whatever and so forth. And then in the quiz that followed afterwards, there would be very, very close, you know, scrutiny of the extent to which students had paid attention to the fact that who the sponsor was, you know, a particular brand of face cream or whatever. And there might even be times where they would sort of quiz the students on, you know, look at the ad on page 5. What is the boy gazing at? Why is the, you know, the girl in the corner so sad? Or just basically just quizzing, you know, using advertising driven material as you know, as a you know, as a classroom material, and then quizzing them. And of course, one of the reasons why advertisers were so successful in getting this into the classrooms was the Depression.
Yeah,
there was so little money for all kinds of books and other material, and also they were so early with a lot of stuff that schools took a lot of time to catch up to, like films and you know, recordings and exciting stuff in the 1930s.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Dr. Inger L. Stoll, a professor in the Institute of Communications Research here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We're discussing her brand new book, just published by University of Illinois Press, Advertising on Trial: Consumer Activism and Corporate Public Relations in the 1930s. We only have a few minutes left, and I'd like to talk about some of the more recent implications of your work. But first, just let's do some closure. You know, this is a battle trying to get rigorous regulation of advertising in the public interest in the 1930s. How did that legislative struggle end?
It failed.
Okay, I guess that
basically,
that saves time.
Basically, through a lot of you know, a lot of you know, events and you know, advertisers working on so many different levels, using so many forms of public relations. And I, you know, I don't have time to go in detail here, but I just talk about that very extensively in my book. And the fact that consumers didn't have the same, you know, pull on Capitol Hill as advertisers did.
I mean, that's a frequent story to Media Matters when we discuss politics in this country.
Yes. And so basically the bill that was passed was a bill that pleased the advertisers to no end. It was written in 1938 and is called the Wheeler-Lee Amendment, amendment to the Federal Trade Commission law that I mentioned in the very early part of this show. And basically it was a gift to advertisers because it did state that false advertising was illegal. But then again, you know, how could you really, you know, how, it was nearly impossible to get the Federal Trade Commission to take a case. So that was sort of, you know, the advertisers got very easily off there. The call for you know, outlawing ambiguous advertising was tossed out completely. And the, sort of the ironic effect was that because blatantly false statements could be arrested and possibly could be prosecuted. I mean, there was always the possibility, although it never really happened very much. Advertisers were more concerned about not putting any statements in their ads. Mm-hmm. So really, the law that was sort of intended to have advertisers provide more information had the opposite effect, because you could not punish ambiguity, but you could punish falsehood.
A direct statement.
Exactly. So then, really, you had ads that had even more ambiguous images.
Puffery, I think, is the term, right?
That's hot air. That's one that's been used. So that's really that law that was written in 1938 is the law we still have today that still regulates advertising.
Now, since 1938, a lot has happened. Our society has become marinated in advertising, a commercial tidal wave since the 1930s. One of the things that you mentioned in your book briefly, but you haven't talked about yet today for obvious reasons, is the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. We're even in the 1930s saying, hey, you can't regulate advertising. You know, corporations have a First Amendment right to speak. Was that a common argument?
No, it was not. And I had gone through so many documents and I read so many trade journals. I put an awful lot of research into this book. And I will say there was one time in passing that someone mentioned the First Amendment. But that was probably one out of
500 million.
50,000 documents, or maybe 100,000 documents I looked at. And that was sort of just in passing. And it didn't really pertain exactly to that regulation. But no, people really understood that, even advertisers understood that, commercial speech was really not, on par with political speech. The First Amendment was supposed to protect political speech, but not.
Our guest is Inger Stoll, author of Advertising on Trial, Consumer Activism and Corporate Public Relations in the 1930s. What do you think the lessons are from this book that apply to today? What do you think if someone reads this book will learn that will help them understand what's going on in the United States or maybe the world 2006?
I think that what sort of struck me as I was working on this, and I think, probably other people had the same reaction, is, how little we know about this period and how, how sound many of those criticisms that people had in the 1930s were and how we have sort of been, sort of accustomed to think that advertising really does, have this kind of, natural place.
Yeah, and along those lines, we've talked about fraudulent ads and sort of bogus claims or misleading claims or ambiguous claims. There was also a critique just of the amount of commercialism in society, of having advertising in schools, of having advertising saturate every aspect of our lives. That was part of their critique too, wasn't there?
Yes. Of course, if you look back to the 30s, there seemed to be a very, very light, saturation compared to today. But there's many, many comparisons. And the thing that's sort of hopeful, I think, is that, if you look at this struggle, this is sort of the blueprint in the kind of public relations effort that's going on today. And the fact that advertising is still regulated, offers a small, ray of hope. Because advertising, is regulated and the Federal Trade Commission could take that much more seriously. And we could also get momentum to sort of expand that regulation. And if you look at people's concerns with advertising, it's just mounting.
We've only got a few seconds left. Inger L. Stoll, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Dr. Stoll, thank you for joining us today. Author of the new book, Advertising on Trial: Consumer Activism and Corporate Public Relations of the 1930s. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back 1 week from today. See you then.